From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. On today's show, local comic book artist Langdon Foss discusses his work.
The book is ostensibly about a group of hacker kids fleeing a dystopian future American government in search of a mystical place in Africa where matter can essentially be hacked.
Retired Navy SEAL and author of the Navy SEAL Firearms Training Manual, Chris Synog, discusses his thoughts on what it means to be a responsible gun owner.
You know, one of the things that really surprises people is the very first thing I teach when I teach shooting is I teach things like meditation, using visualization, and positive thinking.
Big Something intern Charlie Neves tells the story of Mission Wolf, an off-the-grid wolf sanctuary in the mountains west of Pueblo.
The land is in the wolf's name. This is their place. Any human that's on the property is simply here to give themselves to help the animals have a better quality of life.
And I sit down with KRCC music director Vicky Greger to look back at the life and work of the late David Bowie.
You would be hard to find somebody who had that much amazing music and that much change. I mean, it was like, God, is this guy real?
All that today on The Big Something. Artist Langdon Foss arrived late to the comic books game. An illustrator by trade, Foss decided to try his hand at comics in his 30s after seeing the possibilities of Japanese and indie comics in the early 2000s. Since then, he's illustrated for Marvel, DC, and Image Comics, the publisher of the now famous Walking Dead series. Foss came by the studios to talk with KRCC's Noel Black about his recent 4-issue comic book series, The Surface, written by Alish Kott, which was released by Image Comics last year.
How did you get started drawing comic books? Was this something you set out to do or not? How'd you get here?
Even back when I was in college, I dreamed of doing comics, but in a different way. Yeah, it was definitely after about 15 years of freelance illustration that I decided to get serious about it, and that was about 10 years ago. I've always liked comics, but it was only after I discovered the European comics and the Japanese comics that I realized the potential for the medium. And it,
so that, you weren't like a, you know, DC Marvel fanboy when you were a kid?
Well, I was a Marvel boy. You know, I read a few Marvel titles and thought I knew what the medium was all about and thought the stories were good. But it was after visiting a comic book store in Wichita, Kansas, that I first discovered my first Japanese comic books and the quality to the art and the nuances of the stories and the complexities of the characters was just opened my eyes. And I don't write comics very much, but it definitely impressed me visually. So that's when I started dreaming about it. And yeah, like I said, it was 10 years ago, about 15 years ago, that I decided to get serious.
Do you think that there was that moment in the early 2000s where especially, you know, comic books started being talked about as graphic novels? Was that sort of the moment for you when it was like, and it was also just wider availability, wider distribution of titles from around the world? I remember reading Watchmen and The Sandman and being like, oh, you know, I never really liked the stories in most action comic books. They always seemed really contrived, and it was sort of discovering these headier comic books that also had the amazing visuals of a good DC or Marvel comic book that it was like, oh wow, there's something to bite into here. Was that part of it for you?
I don't think consciously, but I was definitely around the time that I discovered them and started reading them. And something else that the serialized books like Spider-Man and X-Men have is repetition. You know, every 50 issues, you know, they kill everybody off or they reinvent everybody and there's the same dramas. And it seemed to be that the writers just kept digging deeper and deeper for thinner and thinner stories to justify selling books. And, you know, it's fun. I mean, superhero books, there's a charm about them. But they're not sophisticated, and if there's no end in sight, like a graphic novel would tell an entire arc of a story, presumably the writer knows how the story is going to end, and so you can develop the story with complexity, sophistication, nuance in a way that you couldn't otherwise. So yes, and of course, you know, there's no way I could do a monthly book with my style. Dear viewers, dear listeners, my style is quite detailed.
Yeah, it is very detailed.
And I take a long time. So it was hard for me to imagine myself being able to do a monthly book. But, you know, a six-issue miniseries, the equivalent thereof in a graphic novel format, that's conceivable. So Get Jiro, I did in, what was that, 2013? It was a couple years ago, let's say that.
And Get Jiro is a story about it was written by the chef and sort of television personality, Anthony Bourdain. And it's a story about a sushi chef who arrives in LA and finds himself in the middle of, and it's this fantasy world where chefs sort of rule LA mm-hmm. in this sort of gangster style. And very charming. Anyway, sorry. I just wanted to give listeners a sense of what it's
right.
About.
It's very, very Bourdain-y. It's over the top in many, many ways. But it was lots of fun. But it was a one shot until the prequel, which came out last year, 2015. Not drawn by me, but knowing how the book is going to end, you know, having full control over the universe, not inheriting any characters from other writers, other artists. That's how I like to draw. I like to have control over as much as possible. And I think that really lets my art flourish.
I want to talk to you about the four-shot series that came out and finished up just last year, The Surface, which is fantastic. And in many ways, I think, given what you just said about, you know, the creative satisfaction, you know, reading it, it seems like kind of, you know, an illustrator's dream story in a lot of ways, and literally because there's so much dream aspect to it. I'm going to let you describe what the story is about a little bit. It's a beautiful series, but maybe you could kind of outline this very complicated arc. Just briefly.
Right. I will try. Well, ostensibly, the book was written by Alish Kott, Czech expat come American super writer. He's, I don't know, you just have to read the book and describe him to yourself. He was amazing to work with. A very, very dreamlike imagery, meta-textualization. The book is ostensibly about a group of hacker kids fleeing a dystopian future authoritarian American government in search of a mystical place in Africa called The Surface, where matter can essentially be hacked. That's the groundwork. But of course, things get stranger from there. Working with Alish was a wonderful experience because the challenges of conveying what he put on paper in art were sublime. It really, really pushed me in new directions. But we weren't sure how the book was going to end until it ended, and then it ended perfectly, I think.
Yeah, I was reminded of reading Alan Moore for the first time, where it's like a comic book can also be a work of philosophy. It can be a work of literature. It can be so many different things. And it takes you on many different rides. You're never quite sure what reality you're in on the page. And is that part of it important to you as well as an illustrator?
It's important to me that the reader walks away feeling altered. And to be clear, Alish could probably write this story in prose in a way that would affect the reader in a similar way, but it was a very gratifying experience for me because I felt like my art was crucial to conveying the layers and the complexities and the recursive structure of the story.
The other thing, you know, your style of drawing is obviously really detailed. It reminds me of sort of Frank Miller circa Ronin in a lot of ways, which is also incredibly detailed and very, you know, busy with lines and marks. So as far as that goes, you know, I think there's this sense that most comic book illustrators are chained to their table sort of 24 hours a day. Is that true for you? And did you know what you were getting into when you decided you wanted to do comics?
I did not know what I was getting into. And yet that is what is required. It's not as bad as being a Japanese comic book artist. I saw a graph recently of the work week of a Japanese comic book artist, and it is grueling. It is torturous. It is not the life. It's not a life worth living, in my opinion. I say that now. On my deathbed, maybe I'll look back and wish I had put in those hours and sacrificed those relationships. But yes, it takes a lot of work, especially when you're working with independent comics. The Surface came out with Image, and Image is a magnificent company that fosters talent by allowing the creators to keep the rights to the book.
And it was created in part by Robert Kirkman, who many people would know was a creator of The Walking Dead, which was a comic long before it was a television series, just for those who might not know.
And that, of course, is the golden magical home run of glory. If you can do a book that it sells like The Walking Dead and then gets picked up by TV and with all the merchandising, most of that money goes right back into the pockets of the creators and not the publisher, which is wonderful for the creator. That doesn't happen very often. The Surface has not been a similar home run. We're hoping it will be a slow burn because the feedback we get from people is so warm. It's so wonderful.
It's a great comic book. I think there is something transformative about The Surface. So what are you working on now? What's next? Do you have the luxury of sort of waiting for a project, and do you have any of your own scripts that you're wanting to work on?
Yes and yes. I am definitely busy. Lots of little things. The last thing I did with Marvel was for was a She-Hulk mini, like a She-Hulk story for a Christmas special, which was lots of fun. So I wish I could say more about what I will be doing with Marvel in the future, but there are pieces in play right now that I just can't talk about in too much detail. I do have scripts that I am working on, and I would like to publish those with a company like Image, because really having the relaxed timetable, the ability to spend the time I want to include the detail I want on a story, that's where I want to be, and I think that's what readers expect from my art.
Langdon Foss, thanks so much for coming in.
All right, thanks, Noel.
That was KRCC's Noel Black, speaking with artist and comic book illustrator Langdon Foss. You can listen to that interview again and get links to Foss's work at krcc.org. This is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. Retired Navy SEAL Chris Synog literally wrote the book on weapons training for the secretive elite military combat team, the Navy SEALs. Since leaving the SEALs in 2009, Synog has adapted his training program for civilians and just released the book Navy SEAL Shooting. Noel Black spoke to Synog in December, shortly after the shootings in Colorado Springs and San Bernardino. This interview is an outtake from the most recent episode of Wish We Were Here, which was on Dragon Man, the alleged most armed citizen in Colorado. In his interview, Synog began by outlining what he believes is the kind of training people should undergo before buying a firearm.
Even before you buy a gun, even if it's not a requirement, people need to understand that training needs to come first. But so many people right now, especially with these shootings and all the stuff in the news, they're right to want to do something about it, but their decision to just go buy, a big gun, the largest caliber, or the one that carries the most amount of ammunition, that should be your very last decision you make. Because even people who are, I won't say properly trained, but people who have a lot of firearms experience going to a firing range, that goes all completely out the window when, somebody breaks into your house in the middle of the night and, you grab your gun under your bed and you try to shoot them. But if you had trained properly, if you had trained mentally and physically first, you would be able to understand how to react in that situation. And the first thing you do is to decide, I'm going to get a gun and I'm going to put it under my bed and you don't train with it, or you just go to the range and shoot with it, you are definitely more likely to cause harm to yourself or someone else. So you really need to, you know, get proper training. And really what it comes down to is your mindset and how you train. That's what's going to make you a better shooter and a safer shooter. And in the end, if need be, have to deal with one of these violent encounters.
So for people who wouldn't necessarily know what you were talking about in terms of mindset, can you give a brief summary of what you mean by that?
Your body simply does what your mind tells it to do. And it's really important to start there. You know, one of the things that really surprises people is the very first thing I teach when I teach shooting is I teach things like meditation, using visualization, and positive thinking. And, you know, these aren't typically aspects that people think about when it comes to shooting, but, you know, that stuff is, you know, much more important than shooting perfectly, you know, every round just by going to the range every day trying to learn.
It sounds like a martial art. It sounds like a spiritual practice.
You know, I, in my opinion, I look at martial arts as fighting arts. And, you know, this one just happens to be fighting with a firearm. So, yeah, it is a martial art. And I think a lot of people lost focus of that or never even had focus of that. But that's truly what it is. And maybe, you know, it came from I've been doing karate pretty much my entire life since I was 12 years old. Yeah, I definitely have a background in that, you know, like meditation.
Talk about that a little more.
So with meditation, I know it scares a ton of people when they hear that because they think that they need to go in a cave somewhere and, you know, it's some Eastern religion thing. You know, a lot of people, including myself, are Christians and they have concerns about it. So I sent out, I think there is like 24 or something verses from the Bible that say to, you know, meditate, you know, where the Bible tells you to, you know, meditate and stuff. And every religion has it. But in the end, all meditation is, it's learning to just quiet your mind. That whole aspect of mental training is really one of the biggest things. It's literally having people say, you know, this has changed every aspect of my life. And I look at it like, you know, in a violent situation, if somebody were to kick in my door right now, my mind needs to process the information as quickly as possible and come up with the right answer for me to be able to survive that. And that's all that meditation is. It's learning to focus and clear your mind so when you need to find other information that it comes a lot quicker.
So it's about preparing yourself so that you don't do something stupid. Do you see part of the purpose of training with firearms to be so that you do not have to use them?
Oh, definitely. If you're preparing your mind, you're going to figure out ways to avoid that. Part of preparing your mind is learning situational awareness. If I can choose the right situations or if I can be aware of what's happening around me better, I'm much more likely to be able to avoid those situations or, you know, react to it a lot faster.
For people who are not firearms owners, who do not have conceal and carry or who do not open carry, what's your advice to people who may go into a crowded public place and are concerned about these shooter events? What is your advice to them for how to think as they go into a situation like that in order to, you know, as you said, prepare themselves mentally?
The prepare part, that's number one. Doing meditation, you know, I know it's hard for people to grasp and think, how is meditation going to help me, you know, without a gun in this situation? The short answer would be just trust me, it will. I've been teaching this for 25 years. I know how it works. It's super easy to do. Meditate and then have a plan. You know, even if you're by yourself, have a plan. Okay, if something happens over here, there's an exit this way. If something happens over there, there's an exit. I personally don't go into very many crowded situations. You know, stay on the outside, always you know, if you can keep your back to a wall, carrying things with you, like, you know, it doesn't have to be a firearm. A flashlight can be very effective. Going back to preparing, being in good physical shape can help you. You know, I tell people all the time, the number one thing you should practice doing is running away from a fight. You know, it's the best thing to do. And people will go, oh, you're a Navy SEAL. Navy SEALs don't run away. Navy SEALs are professionals at running away. You know, like there's certain times if it's part of our plan, we'll do a direct action and go attack somebody. But that's our plan. You know, we've planned that fight out. We don't want to fight somebody else's fight. So if we call it being ambushed, you know, the number one thing you can do, we say, get off the X. And getting off the X means the X is wherever that attack is coming to. You know, if it's a vehicle and you're in a vehicle that's getting attacked, get out of the vehicle. You know, a lot of people will think, oh, you know, I can't do that. Get out of the vehicle. If you're in a crowded situation, you're in a crowd and it starts getting attacked, you're in a movie theater, you know, somebody starts shooting, the number one thing you can do is get out, start moving, you know, plan what you're going to do, you know, whatever it is, you know, have a plan, just think through it. And then there's just a lot better chance of you executing.
Do you see this as a way of not being afraid?
Definitely. You know, people my whole life have, at least, you know, my whole adult life, you know, common question, you know, oh, Navy SEAL, how can you do that? You know, how can you not be afraid to go, you know, kick in a door and you know there's going to be shooting on the other side and, you know this? Or how can you jump out of planes or blow stuff up or whatever it is? And it's because of training. Anything you're well trained at, you're not going to be afraid of. You know, you're going to understand, oh, it's my job, you know, and hopefully that fear that you have now leads to you getting the proper training that you need.
That was KRCC's Noel Black speaking with Chris Synog. Synog is a retired Navy SEAL and the author of the book Navy SEAL Shooting. Black originally spoke with Synog for the most recent episode of Wish We Were Here on Dragon Man, the alleged most armed citizen in Colorado. You can hear that episode online at krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back. From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. The relationship between wolves and humans has been a long and complicated one, especially here in the West. Questions of whether and how wolves should be protected have been hotly debated, and they continue to stir strong emotions on both sides of the issue. For decades, the staff and volunteers at Mission Wolf, a wolf sanctuary in the mountains near West Cliff, Colorado, have been working to change people's perceptions of wolves and protect those wolves that can't survive in the wild. Big Something intern Charlie Neves recently visited Mission Wolf and has this story.
Wild is free. And when you try to own something, it's no longer free. So it can't be wild. And in a sense, by especially Americans' view of trying to tame nature, we've destroyed it.
You arrive at the Mission Wolf Sanctuary after driving more than 15 miles down a dirt road in the wet mountains of southern Colorado. Stepping out into the foothills, it's hard to believe that as many people make it out here as they do. Mission Wolf was started in 1986 by Kent Weber, the man you just heard, and his wife Tracy.
My name's Kent. I've had a chance to talk with most of you here, but Mission Wolf came after that old name, Mission Impossible. I think to keep any animal in a cage and make it happy, you know, how do you do that? That was like an impossible mission.
Many wolves that are born every year end up living in cages. Because they don't learn the necessary skills for survival, a reintroduction into the wild is not an option. Kent stepped in to solve this problem. His aim has been to provide wolves born in captivity with as close to a natural home as possible. Over time, the mission grew into an educational program that aims to protect the wolf population through trying to dispel some of the myths about the wolf. Kent has devoted his life to this pursuit.
More wolves live in cages than live in the wild, and I felt that was pretty sad. And when we came across a wolf that was either going to lose its life or stay in that little cage all its life, we're like, okay, we can do better. And if you do anything, do it right. So we got a federal license, a state license. Everybody I met had one thing in common, horrified, and I learned that humans destroy what we're afraid of.
Mission Wolf houses 34 wolves on over 200 acres of land. Some of these come from homes that were not able to care for them. Some of them come from zoos, shelters, wildlife safari parks, and breeders. Most of them had nowhere else to go.
Most of the wolves that Mission Wolf takes in are ones that the other facilities declined. They're the ones that have aggression problems, fear problems, not socialized. So we try to keep Mission Wolf for just those animals that have absolutely no other option except death. And we've done a pretty good job of taking care of quite a few.
Close to these cages, there's an entire living community. It consists of camping space for visitors, 6 heated teepees, and a couple of small cabins where the long-term staff live. There is a central office, 2 cars that run on corn oil, a greenhouse, and solar panels, which are the only source of power. Mission Wolf seems to be an experiment in symbiotic living between wolves and humans. Volunteers come from all over the world to live in close quarters with the wolves. One of these is JD. He's from Canada and has been at Mission Wolf for 4 months.
I believe that like each wolf has their own personality. And this guy over here, he's one of my buddies. This is Ilyamna. He's a full Arctic wolf, and he's a goofball sometimes. You'll meet wolves here that like are a little bit sassy, like they actually like trying to like push your buttons a little bit. Okay. Some of them are actually really skittish and really shy.
Okay.
And then some of them like Ilyamna are just goofy, and some of them are just, you know, more content, like Raven. Raven's just a sweetheart.
Raven, get up here.
There you go, that a girl.
What do you think it is about the wolves that draws all these volunteers here?
The wolf is the one species that will split a human's mind in half, unlike any other species. The thing is, one side of the human mind goes to fear. The big bad wolf, it ate grandma, it ate all the little pigs. If you're wolf-like, you're a villain, you're bad. Then the other side of your brain goes to admiration. Oh my God, if there's a wilderness that's a symbol of future and life and hope, it's the wolf. The wolf is now hugely admired worldwide as a symbol of hope for the future or hope for wilderness.
Wolves have been a species that was eradicated from most of the lower 48 because people didn't like them. And that attitude is still very prevalent, especially in the West.
This is Doug Smith, a wildlife biologist and the project leader for the Gray Wolf Restoration Project in Yellowstone National Park. He's been working with wolves for over 23 years. He's also in charge of restoring wolves back to the Yellowstone ecosystem and studying the effects that this restoration has. Wolves have been largely removed from much of the United States. And, Smith says, sanctuaries like Mission Wolf play an important role in the broader effort to reintroduce wolves into wild ecosystems.
So wolves have a bad image. You know, wolves won't be on the landscape, and the benefits of having them and restoring nature won't occur unless people's attitudes change about wolves. And wolf sanctuaries and educational places kind of lead the charge on this.
According to Smith, wolves play an important role in ecosystems, primarily by controlling elk and deer populations. The result of this has a cascading beneficial effect on the ecosystem as a whole. However, any attempt at reintroducing wolves into their natural habitat often comes with opposition.
Well, the image of the wolf that people don't like is that the bloodthirsty killer, plain and simple. But they also compete with us because we want to do the same thing they want to do. Their primary prey in the West is elk and deer, and that's our primary wild prey as well. We're hunters too. And then our other primary prey are domestic livestock, and it does not happen much. But, you know, domestic livestock are former wild prey. You know, we just husbanded them into be domestic, and, you know, wolves occasionally kill them. And so wolves take essentially what we want, and so we don't want them. Primarily, it's that they want the same things we want.
So if you all want to come over here, I'm going to teach you how to feed. Okay, so if we only throw in one direction, only one wolf is going to feed. We have shy wolves and confident wolves in each enclosure. So if you only chuck in one direction, what's going to happen?
They're
going to eat, exactly. So go to rapid fire all different directions.
The relationship between wolves and humans has long been one of fear. But Kent feels that when people see these captive wolves up close and spend time in their presence, they can learn things about themselves.
Today, you saw all the people that came from all over. They just wanted and desired to have this connection with nature. And when that connection is physical and those teeth of the wolf are touching your teeth and looking you in the eye at the same time, when a wolf does that to a human, it's an awakening, I think, within the human that gets you past that fear.
How are you doing? Do you girls up there see how big that head is now that he's right up close? And if you look at Maggie, she's the white one. She was pure black as a puppy. Did you guys notice how she's got her ears down? She's kind of grinning right now. She knows everybody's eyes on her. And she loves to work the audience. She's met 250,000 people. Yep.
Kent has made it a goal to increase people's awareness of wolves all over the country. Through a program called the Ambassador Tour, he has brought wolves onto TV show sets and college campuses. He's put them in the laps of Hell's Angels, and he's even brought them into ranchers' meetings. Wolf visits are an important part of Kent's work, and through this process, he's seen that people can benefit from wolves as much as the wolves can benefit from people.
Now that we've learned to work with wolves, we're working with many adolescent students. We're working with very traumatized veterans of war. We're working with behavior programs and therapy groups. And the therapists go, I worked with this person that went through this terrible trauma, and they don't trust anybody. But you put them in a pen with a wild animal. And the wolf especially is so social, it'll walk right up and walk right through them. And the kids go, that animal just knew how I felt. And I think because they feel heard, they feel that something understands them, it gives them tremendous confidence. And we've had therapists come back and go, oh my God, that helped this person so much.
Gotcha. I gotcha.
This is Mike. He's been the animal caretaker here for 2 years.
I mean, I came out here some kid just wanting to be around wolves, and I've developed into a person that, one, I didn't really know I could be, and that's one of the things Mission Wolf can do, is really open your eyes. And I think the wolves are a big factor in that, and the wolves can really bring the best out of anybody. And just taking 2 seconds to stare into the eyes of tiger or stare into magpie's eyes, it really kind of humbles you for a second.
In order for efforts to reintegrate wolves in the West to be successful, people would need to not just tolerate, but welcome and make space for these animals. Mission Wolf models this relationship.
It makes you realize that, you know, you're not the only thing on this planet. Realize that there's a whole world out there that could probably use our help. We are, in general, a wolf sanctuary, and this is the animal's home. I mean, the land is in the wolf's name. This is their place. Any human that's on the property is simply here to give themselves to help the animals have a better quality of life. We don't put our animals on display. We don't force them to do anything that they don't want to. It's completely their decision for anything that they want to do. I mean, I'm number 35 out here, technically. The wolves are 1 through 34, and I'm 35.
Kent's 30.
Hey. Well, then Tracy's 30. Oh, okay. Well, I'm like 102.
Down into the 40s.
Whatever.
Let's make a list.
Yeah. Well, okay.
I'm down in the 100s.
If Mission Wolf succeeds in their goal, they will one day be obsolete. But for now, they welcome visitors and hope to continue to foster a greater understanding between man and wolf.
That was Big Something intern Charlie Neves telling the story of Mission Wolf, a wolf sanctuary located in the mountains east of Westcliff. To hear that story again, head to krcc.org. This is the Big Something from KRCC. We'll be right back.
I'm riding back to my blueberry glen. I'm riding back to my blueberry glen.
From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is The Big Something, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. In our final segment, we turn to the stars, or specifically the star man, David Bowie. On January 8th, his 69th birthday, Bowie released his 25th studio album, Black Star, to wide acclaim. Critics heralded the album as a resurrection, a return to form, possibly even the beginning of a brilliant new chapter in the long and winding career of a rock icon. 2 days later, much to the shock and surprise of many in the music world, David Bowie passed away. It was the end of a long and largely private battle with cancer. In the wake of his death, we invited KRCC music director Vicky Greger into the studio to talk about Bowie's life and legacy and to take a look back at the music he left behind. Vicky Greger, welcome to the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jake.
So we're here today to talk about David Bowie, the masterful, wonderful David Bowie, passed away January 10th. So we wanted to talk a little bit about his music, about what he meant to you, Vicky. And so I'd just like to start off maybe by asking you your first experience with David Bowie. Do you remember the first time you heard a David Bowie song?
I do. So this goes back, we're sort of real timing this, but I was on a car trip, and it must have been for some, you know, the Latin Club or some kind of group like that. We were going somewhere, and Space Oddity was playing on the radio.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
We were just, all of us, mesmerized because it had, you know, here's this incredible voice, here's this incredible story, and all of the changes that go through that song. You're like, wow, this is a radio song. You know, we just hadn't quite heard anything like that. And I needed to see what he looked like. So within a few days, I managed to find, you know, take some doing because there was no interwebs. You know, you had to, like, go find what he looks like, you know. So that was, I can remember being in that car and just being held captive by it.
This is ground control to Major Tom.
And so let's just jump right into his career and talk a little bit about the many phases, the many faces of David Bowie. And maybe if you could give us a little bit of background on Bowie's early career, kind of starting with Space Oddity, and that was 1969.
Mm-hmm.
He was 22 years old at the time, right? And so maybe just talk a little bit about how his career unfolded.
Well, we're rolling right into this golden decade of his. But, you know, the backstory to Bowie is clearly someone who knows his way around the theatrical aspect of rock and roll. But, you know, had his interest in music. He spent some time with the Lindsay Kemp mime troupe, and that was very important to him from all the things I've read. It really helped him. I can't quote him exactly, but he talks a lot about really bringing the components of his body together through mime. Now he starts making records. There's Space Oddity. Then you're rolling into The Man Who Sold the World, which is such a great record. And now we're really starting to take off. I mean, that was a very solid record. But then you get Hunky Dory, and that is certainly one of my favorite records by him. Beautiful acoustic. The Anthony Newley parts of his vocals, he wasn't quite unleashing them the same way on Hunky Dory, but these solid songs that just tip the hat to some of the people he really admired. Andy Warhol, one of the best songs on that record, talking about Lou Reed, talking about Dylan.
Like to take a cement fix, be a standing cinema. Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are. But the people in my brain, two new pens to have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall.
So there's Hunky Dory, you know, with his long, beautiful Breck hair. And then bam, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Here comes Ziggy Stardust.
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama, papa coming for you. I'm the space invader. I'll be a rock and rollin' bitch for you. Keep your mouth shut. Just squawk like a big monkey bird. And I'm busting up my brains for the world.
And let's talk a little bit about that moment when Ziggy Stardust comes out, because he had been doing, you know, Hunky Dory has a kind of an acoustic feel, mm-hmm. almost as though it's in some way referencing the folk thing that was happening at
pastoral.
The time.
Yeah,
this kind of pastoral sound. And then Ziggy Stardust is just out of another dimension, and it's hard rocking, and it's, you know, this glam thing. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, to the extent that anybody had up to that point kind of pigeonholed David Bowie as one kind of thing, was there a sense that, like, he was taking just a hard left turn into some other territory that maybe some people didn't even like?
Right. I think there were a few people I can think of that were like, whoa, what happened there? I found it so exciting and amazing, because there it was, the reveal was starting to happen, that you were going to be on a ride for each record. And it's funny, because now what are we in? Four records in. And Bowie's already singing about the rise and fall of this iconic, you know, star. And to be sort of that new in your career still, and already talk about perhaps the pitfalls of being that person for everyone, I thought was pretty amazing. But I think Ziggy grabbed so many people. That just was such a great record. I still play it. I just played it end to end last week, and it works. It holds up. It's wonderful. You know, it's just one song after another. I wouldn't even know what to. It was hard to pick. Let's put it that way, a favorite song there. But I think he gives notice on that record that you're in for a ride.
Keep your electric eye on me, babe. Put your ray gun to my head. Press your space close to my love.
And so Ziggy Stardust comes out, and then his next album is Aladdin Sane.
Aladdin Sane.
And Aladdin Sane is kind of a version of Ziggy Stardust. Is that right?
You know, when you think about, now we're starting to talk about the way Bowie looks, what he's doing, what skin he's shedding or what he's trying on. And so you can see a similarity. I mean, physically, there's Ziggy, there's Aladdin Sane, there's the orange burr, you know, shag haircut, there's, you know, that similar look to a rock and roll star. But then you go over to Aladdin Sane coming out of Ziggy, which ends with a rock and roll suicide. So in a way, he did cap that record. And Aladdin Sane just rocks. I mean, that is just like a rock and roll record. I mean, you think about Panic in Detroit, Watch That Man. You know, again, I think he's always inviting us to try on the new suit of clothes.
Small jean genius snuck off to the city, strung out on lasers and slashed back blazers, and ate all your razors while pulling the waiters, talking about Monroe and walking on Snow White. New York's a go-go and everything tastes nice.
You know, I think one of the other things that's interesting, and you kind of alluded to this with Ziggy Stardust, is the way that he was a rock star, but he was also playing a rock star in this way where he feels like he's at a remove from the whole thing. But it's like he has such a mastery over how people present themselves, how rock stars present themselves, how to kind of push it a little bit further, but also give people something that's has something familiar that they can latch on to.
Right, exactly. It's sort of like he drew the blueprint for it and lived it exactly at the same time. You know, I mean, when you think about some of the music, I mean, we're coming out of, you know, the 60s into the 70s, you know, now disco's a little bit over here and the beginnings of house music and stuff, but you're coming off of, you know, a decidedly kind of Grateful Dead, Fillmore East, Fillmore West, all the stuff that was in the later 60s. And within a few years, this guy's Ziggy. I mean, like, where does that come from, right? But yeah, he is the thing that he plays. He invents it, and then he observes it, and then he takes it to that next step. Let yourself go!
So Bowie has a couple more records, Pinups, Diamond Dogs, and then we jump ahead to Young Americans, which was his taking on a sort of a new direction. It was like he left some of the hard-rocking Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane,
right,
that
the
sound
pin-ups.
Behind, the Pinups.
Right, and then Diamond Dogs. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. There was a very beautiful arc there.
Yeah, and then Young Americans, you start getting what he called Plastic Soul.
Well, you know, when we got to that, because he's using Sigma Studios for the most part on that record, you know, the Philadelphia sound. And it's interesting with that record, too, because he's personally coming off some pretty hard living. At this point, I think he's coming off of being secluded in L.A., doing way too many drugs. I think he was living on cocaine and milk, might be the famous story there. Don't quote me. I can't prove that was true. Incredibly thin, not healthy, kind of paranoid. So it was kind of interesting that during that time period, he was able to gather these amazing soul singers around him and make a record that's so soulful, like Young Americans. But yet, he's kind of the thin white Duke at this point, but he's surrounding himself. It's almost like he's trying to find his soul again. Now we're at, what, 74, 75? But I think it's the way that he was putting himself back together. Ever-loving face, right? On the whole human race. He says, I'm somebody. He's got his eye on yourself. His hand on your heart. He says, don't hurry.
So moving into Bowie's next phase, out of Young Americans, the next album he comes out with is one that many people see as a real masterpiece, one of his great records, Station to Station.
Mm, yes.
Can you talk about that album?
Well, there's the Thin White Duke for you, throwing darts in lovers' eyes. And this is tying in with his movie role now. You know, during all this, he makes The Man That Fell to Earth and is that's a good movie. He is very good in it and is most likely even playing himself again in some ways. But Station to Station, an amazing record. But when I think about a thing like Station to Station, now he's getting, I don't know, there's almost a hard edge to it. But there's some beautiful love songs on that record too. But you cannot beat Station to Station and the way he builds that beat and those guitars come in. So now we've gone through this this acoustic folk kind of music. We've had glam. We've already flirted with like what would become new romantic kind of music. You know, flat out rock and roll, got that saxophone going. Then he's meandering over, let's make a movie and let's do Young Americans. And now it's Station to Station. And you know, here's prog rock, you know, David doing one of the best ones ever. And then he needs to leave. He really needs to really just get out of the country and teams up with Brian Eno. And there's Eno doing the things he does, coming off of Roxy Music and some of his own pretty spectacular solo records. These two find each other.
And then so Bowie moves to West Berlin and records the Berlin Trilogy, as it's called. What were those albums?
So Low, Heroes, and Lodger. And so I can only guess what he and Brian Eno came up with. I do know... during the Low sessions, he wasn't shy, or maybe Brian Eno wasn't shy either, to scrap whole concepts and ideas and start all over again. So they really went through a lot of ideas. They play out in the studio, though, and then they'll listen, and maybe a week's work, 2 weeks' work, it'll be like, no, go for a walk around Berlin, absorb the club scene, absorb some stuff going on, come back to the studio with those fresh ears. Lots of instrumental stuff, some Baroque kind of things going on now.
And Heroes is probably the best known album from that period. And maybe we should just take a quick listen to the title track
from that
album. Oh,
yes. Yes, we should.
All right.
We can be heroes. Just for one day. And you can be me. And I'll drink all the time. 'Cause we're lovers.
Oh, and listen to what you hear there. There's Bowie. There's that kind of cool, raggedy rock and roll thing going on. There's the Eno treatments kind of propelling it forward. That is just spectacular, those minds coming together.
You know, the thing that's, I think, so striking about David Bowie was just the way that he represented the avant-garde in some sense. You know, he was this artist who was experimenting, who was pushing boundaries, who was thinking differently about sexuality, about music, and about what was possible musically. And yet he was also commercially a hugely successful artist. You know, there aren't a lot of examples of people who transgressed boundaries and pushed people forward and really experimented in the ways that he did while also bringing a lot of people along with him. But would you say it's fair to say that Bowie's musical legacy, the time that people really see him as contributing the most to contemporary music, was that period between when Space Oddity came out in 1969 and the end of his Berlin period in 1979?
Absolutely. You would be hard to find somebody who had that much amazing music and that much change in a 10-year period. And I mean, it was like, God, is this guy real? I mean, who is this guy, you know? How do you start with a space oddity and end up, you know, with some of the stuff that were on the Berlin trilogies?
And so we should wrap up with Bowie's final album, Black Star, which was released on January 8th, the Friday before he died. It was also his 69th birthday.
Yes.
It's an incredible album. It really, especially if people hadn't been paying attention to Bowie's output, hearing Black Star, it was like, where did this come from? This is incredible.
Right. Sitting down with that record, it was like, I mean, start with with Black Star and then rolling into Lazarus. When you hear Lazarus now, that you know what you know. Sad as it is, it's almost like he left us with this Valentine. He left us with his exit strategy.
And when you watch the video for Lazarus, in which he's in a hospital bed singing these lyrics, you know, look up now, I'm in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's speaking through the screen right to you. And there's this incredibly eerie feeling to it where it really does feel like he's managed to take his own death and turn it into a performance, turn it into an extension of his art, taking on something like the most real thing that anybody could ever deal with.
This is why the man is a genius and really shared more than, you know, there's the line in Lazarus, it's something to the idea of, you know, now you know everything. And that was pretty staggering to hear, because that's very private stuff, and he let us have it. He did.
Well, on that note, maybe we should just take this out on Lazarus, David Bowie, from his final album, Black Star. Thanks so much, Vicky, for coming in and talking about David Bowie. And he'll be missed.
He will. And thank you, Jake. Part of the process of being able to say goodbye.
Look up here. I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
That was KRCC music director Vicky Greger discussing the life and work of David Bowie. Bowie passed away on January 10th. This will be the last installment of the Big Something radio program. Noel Black and I, the producers of this show, will be shifting our focus to our monthly radio show and podcast, Wish We Were Here, which you can find at krcc.org or on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. We'll also be bringing you more stories and interviews like those you've heard on the Big Something on weekdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Soon, we'll also be debuting a new show during KRCC Presents, featuring KRCC music director Vicky Greger and program director Jeff Bury, and focusing on all the great music and performances that happen here on KRCC. Thanks to everyone who tuned in to The Big Something over the last year. We've really enjoyed putting the show together, and we think you'll really like the new things that we have in store. The Big Something is produced by Noel Black and me, Jake Brownell, for KRCC in Colorado Springs. For more information on any of the guests you heard in this episode, or to hear any part of the show again, head to krcc.org. For KRCC and The Big Something, I'm Jake Brownell.